Dave? Okay.
Okay, it should be recording. No, I think it's recording.
So we'll start. We're going to read Genesis 12, verses 10 on to the end of chapter 13. And then we're going to read 1 Kings 8, 37. We might say a few words before we get to the king's portion. Let's see. Maybe we'll just start reading. Everybody take a chunk of verses.
Yeah.
You can start, Gemma, and we'll go this way around.
Now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, "I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'That is his wife. This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you."
Okay, the next person can read. Verse 14.
When Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. When the officials of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. How much longer?
Another verse.
And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female slaves, female donkeys, and camels.
But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh because of Sarah, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and be gone." And Pharaoh gave his men orders concerning her, and they set him on the way with his wife and all that he had.
All right. Sheila?
Sorry, I'm not up to the
13, chapter 1. Chapter 13, verse 1.
Went out to the Negev. He took his wife and all his possessions with him, as well as Lot. Now Abram was very wealthy in livestock, silver, and gold. And he journeyed from place to place from the Negev as far as Bethel. He returned to the place where he had pitched his tent, and at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. This was the place where he had first built the altar, and there Abram worshipped the Lord.
Lot also went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. So.
And there was a strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanites and the
Perizzites in English, or Perizzi.
Dwelled then in the land, and Abraham said unto Lot, "Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen, for we be brethren."
I like that. We are close relatives.
He said, "Wait, tell me, if you take the land, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. And not lift his eyes and show all the grace of the land. And he was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed to them and from over. Lying began not to go, like the land of Egypt as you go to the rest of the Lord."
Yes, yes. And Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed it, and they separated from each other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of Canaan, and pitched his tent even as far as Jordan. Yeah. But the men of Jordan were
okay, Gary, you want to, do you have, I'll read, he's saying you just have the English open. I'll go ahead and read the rest. After Lot had departed, we're in Genesis 13, verse 14 right now. After Lot had departed, the Lord said to Abram, "Look, from the place where you stand to the north, south, east, and west, I will give all the land that you see to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone is able to count the dust of the earth, then your descendants also can be counted. Get up and walk throughout the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tents and went to live by the oaks of Mamre in Hebron. And he built an altar to the Lord there. Not so much walking, is it? And that is where our portion ends. And as I've just explained to everybody earlier, we just finished reading through a portion of text that would have been read in the triennial cycle. It has been linked to a portion of the prophets. And so now we're going to read through that really quick, and then we'll start a discussion both on these texts themselves and their link together.
Did the word Wedding in those days mean people of the same belief?
No.
No. It meant
family.
People of the
family.
Same family.
Family.
Yeah.
Brethren. Okay.
Yeah. And family, in a very large understanding, can be nation. Even today, you go on the street and someone will say, Ahi, right? My brother. You're part of the same people. Okay.
Is the Hathor portion for the triangle cycle the same as the Hathor for the annual cycle?
No, it is not. And that's why we're doing this study, because we want to see some of the stuff that's been lost to history. And some of the connections that no longer exist because the parashahs changed and the haftarahs changed. So this has been retrieved from probably the Cairo Geniza. If you want more, I can give you the reference of the book here by Charles, I want to say Perrault, but I don't know if it's Perrault.
I'm sure it's Perrault.
Perrault. Charles Perrault. So 1 Kings 8:37, it says, and following, so we don't know exactly how long of a chunk we're dealing with. So what I suggest we do is read to...
You said James or Kings?
Hold on. It kind of repeats itself quite a bit. You know what I'll say? We're going to read to verse 51. All right? So verse 37 to verse 51, and maybe we can start. Neek or Turan, do you have the English there?
Yeah.
Okay. You can go ahead and start with 1 Kings 8, verse 37.
Can we go
around, or you want to... Oh, read a chunk and we'll go around.
Okay. If there is a famine in the land, if there is a plague, blight, mildew, locust, or caterpillar, if there enemy besieges them in any of the cities, whatever flag, whatever sickness there is, whatever prayer, whatever plea there is from any individual, or from all your people Israel, all knowing the afflictions of their own hearts, as they stretch out their hands toward this house, then here in heaven you dwell in place, and give, act, and render to all whose hearts you know, according to all their ways, for only you know what is in every human heart.
Let me just pause right there. Just to put a context, we're talking about Solomon. He's dedicating his temple. And so he has this big, beautiful prayer. Okay, go ahead. Verse 40.
So that they may fear you all the days that they live in the land that you gave to our ancestors.
Okay, and next person can read three verses. Would you like to read?
Yeah.
Or you, would you like to read? No? Okay, David, you can read three verses. Verse 41. So 1 Kings 8, verse 41.
Concerning a foreigner who is not of your people Israel, but has come from a far country for your name's sake, parentheses, for if they will hear of your great name when you are strong at hand and your offspring are, parentheses, when he comes and prays towards this temple, hear in heaven your dwelling place and do according to all for which the foreigner calls you, that all peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel, and that they may know that this temple which I have built is called by your name. 44.
Maybe the next person?
Oh. If thy people go out to battle against the enemy, whithersoever thou shalt and shall pray unto the Lord toward the city which thou hast chosen, and toward the house that I have built for my name.
Then?
45.
45 also. It's the end of the sentence.
So, then hear thou in heaven their prayer and their supplication, and maintain their cause.
All right.
Three more?
Yes.
When they sin against you, for there is no one who does not sin, and you became, and you become angry with them, deliver them to the enemy, and they take them captive to the land of the enemy, far or near. Yet when they come to themselves in the land where they were carried captive, and repent and make supplication to you in the land of those who took them captive, saying, we have sinned and done wrong, we have committed wickedness. Verse 48, if you want. Three verses.
And when they return to you with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of your enemies, who let them away from you and pray to you for your great hand, which you gave to the fathers and the city which you have chosen, and the temple which I have built for your name, then he in heaven will surely praise your glory and their future and maintain his court. Then forgive your people who have sinned against you and all their transgressions which they have transgressed against you, and grant them compassion before those and took them captive, that they may have compassion on them. For they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out of Egypt, out of the iron, that your eyes may be open to the supplication of the servant and the supplication of the people is that you listen to them whenever they call to you.
Okay, great. So what is Egypt compared to here?
A fiery furnace.
Which verse is that?
51. Whom you brought out of Egypt from the middle of the iron smelting furnace. Mitoch Kul HaBarzel. So I see, I'm already thinking, there are many connections between these two portions. One is blatant, and one is subtle. So let's throw them up here. Famine. And the blatant maybe will lead us to the subtle.
How? Where's the famine part?
It's the portion starts with a famine. If there is a famine, right?
Right.
And in Genesis 12, our portion started with, now there was a heavy famine in the land. It was a severe famine.
Also, Naga.
Nega,
sorry.
Okay, so Nega.
What's Nega?
Nega is a touch.
But
it's a bad touch. It's like when God touches someone to punish them, it's often translated sickness, plague.
30, verse 37.
It could be death.
There could be multiple.
It could be leprosy.
There's a range of meaning, basically. But it's a divine touch of punishment, let's say.
So, Nega, I'll say.
Is that a Hebrew word?
Yes. Nega. Ra'av is the Hebrew word here for famine. Ra'av and Nega. So both portions begin mentioning famine. In Genesis, there was a famine. In Kings, if there would be a famine, in his prayer, he's describing all these situations.
Now, let me ask another question. Because in biblical stories, there's very little given to you. They're very artistic because they say one thing and you have to interpret, what does that mean? Many details are left out. And mostly on purpose. It's a certain style they have. But let me ask the question. There's a severe famine in the land. Why?
Because they've sinned.
Okay.
Are you talking about? Yeah. According to verse
10. No, I'm talking about in Genesis.
Lack of food.
But that's where I'm leading to. When there is a famine in this land, most people's conclusion is There's sin somewhere. In biblical authors' eyes.
The Most High wants to do something.
Could be.
Cause it offense.
It could be.
Yeah, sometimes he even said that.
Sometimes he even said it. Remember?
Not because of sin, but because he said, I want you to turn to me.
Sure. When this land was promised, one of the descriptions of the land is it is a land that depends on rain. This is a key thing. Because if you're going to live in this land, you must depend on God. Contrast this, what is a land that does not depend on rain?
Egypt.
Egypt. Also you could say Assyria. Why not? What does Egypt have?
River.
A big fat river that we call?
The Nile.
The Nile.
Which means provider.
Well, I don't know where you're getting that from, but what's the name in Hebrew? Ye'ov. Okay, so here we have a description when Lot is looking out over this land and trying to choose where to go, he sees a portion that's totally watered. It says the whole thing is just watered, green like the garden of God, like Egypt. Okay, so the concept of Egypt is stability, security. You know you're going to get water. It's green. It's a garden.
And you.
You can depend on your own plans because it's all there. The Nile isn't going anywhere.
And in the context of the story, Lot has just come from Egypt.
Yeah, he's just come from Egypt.
He's
so
just
like,
experienced. Yeah.
He's just been deprived of that constant security of water, which is a big deal. You can't survive long without water. So we have to correct our concept. When we think of Egypt today, I know I think of sprawling cement city full of dust, right? That's not so attractive. But if you think of Egypt in that day, you're going to think of green, lush garden.
Because it was irrigated, too. So the green
irrigated. They
green,
had very good irrigation systems.
So the green spread beyond
the Nile. They had a good logistics government.
They had good logistics systems. And you can always walk back to the Nile somehow, carry it by donkey, however you carry it, to your garden, and you won't die. You will have water.
Yeah, you can work for it if you work your feet, the cucumbers.
Yeah. And there are also natural flooding of the Nile that already have watered your gardens if they're close enough.
And that's when they work.
Very productive silt.
Not even backbreaking work.
In fact, even today, I mean, the Nile silt is known for its qualities. You can put it, like people put it on their skin, similar to desert tea. It has very good nutrients. Okay. So, we have this contrast in both sections. The section we read, I'm just going to put Genesis here. Let's do this. Genesis 8. Oh, I have not enough room, have I? Egypt. Well, maybe or maybe not. Certainly in the first section, Egypt is this green garden, verdant, awesome place to live. Sorry about my wire. In this, what's Egypt called? An iron smelting furnace. What do you think of when you think of a furnace? In the biblical mindset.
Daniel.
And what was happening in Daniel? What was that all about?
Persecution.
You could say persecution.
Or God delivering out of the furnace.
Uh-huh. Or something called testing. Right? Test someone.
I also think of making the bricks.
Making bricks?
Maybe for the...
True.
The slate. The slate.
And also the gold and silver has to be tested by fire.
Testing by fire. Yeah. That's kind of what I think of. So Egypt, we have a green garden here. And here we have, I'm going to put testing, obviously that's interpretation, furnace. So we're starting to see some subtle differences and some subtle connections.
But when Lot chooses it, he says, like the land of Egypt.
Right.
Like the garden of the Lord. So.
Right. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing. It represents security and wealth and goodness.
Well, they didn't pray Genesis on the last day, the kingdom,
because I wrote it opposite. Okay, there you go. You know, I'm challenged. What can I say? Thank you.
That's an amazing contrast. So
it
what
is.
You're saying is that Lot opts for the easy life.
He does.
Just let's do it our way. Let's go for the
let's
things.
Let's be secure.
Let's be secure. Let's go for the things of the flesh, if you put it into those terms. And what Solomon is saying is seek the Lord, turn to him, trust only in him. I mean, as soon as you get to...
Notice Solomon's prayer is actually...
Dependence on the great name.
It's showing a perspective that is much later in time. Because he's predicting there will be an exile. The people of Israel will be far away, and they'll have to look toward this land that you gave our ancestors. So that's the other connection here. You have a land given to ancestors.
Specifically Avot.
Avot. Okay.
Which you think of
Avot,
Abraham.
The father.
Yeah.
Directly goes back to the patriarch father Abraham.
I mean, that's his name.
Father Abraham, that's his name.
Or even if you do the Shemdosh of
So back to the question, why was there a famine? Here, God had just called, last week we talked about the calling of Abraham. He's just promised him this land, right? So Abraham comes over here, he builds a couple altars, then there's a famine, right? So if you're reading closely, you're reading the text, you're saying, why? How could this happen? What's going on here? And some of the medieval Jewish commentators reading this stuff came to the conclusion that Abraham's being tested, right? What are you going to do when there's a famine in the land? Are you going to pray? Does Abraham pray? No, what does he do? He goes to Egypt. Was that part of the plan?
No.
Yeah, but who's him? Was it Abraham?
Okay, this is all subtle, right? The author doesn't say, by the way, Abraham shouldn't go to Egypt right now, okay? He's just saying, there's a famine in the land, so Abraham went down to Egypt.
But the issue surely around still is, basically he's choosing the same way as Lot is choosing.
In a sense, he's looking for security.
He's looking for security.
He's also looking to survive, so we don't completely blame him, right?
Right.
But we do notice that he didn't pray about it.
Right.
It's not recorded that he prayed about it.
And God didn't tell him to go there.
God didn't tell him to go to Egypt,
no.
Correct. The last information he's gotten from God is, come to the land, I will give you, and your descendants will inherit.
Right.
Right? So, from the best we can see, he should be here.
Do you think it always says what he's prayed about? How much can the Bible keep recording?
Well,
question.
It does. Just the previous passage,
yeah.
It mentions many times he called in the name of the Lord,
yes,
building
right.
altars.
Right.
So the contrast of when it does choose to tell us
right.
and when it doesn't is significant.
Yeah.
So like I said, a biblical story is very short and they're expecting you to interpret. There are huge gaps that you must interpret. We're not given people's internal motives most of the time. What we are given are their actions. And so we have to kind of deduce the greater context.
And the fact of what they did, right or wrong, that's
and the fruit of what they did was a little sojourn in Egypt, overall a good thing.
Well, he comes out with lots of goodies.
Okay, that's true.
And he goes down, leaves the famine, he goes down, he barters with his wife, and thankfully never.
Would you have wanted to experience that little thing that happened in Egypt?
Were the goodies worth it?
I certainly wouldn't have.
You're saying if you were Sarah.
Even if I were Abraham, because
caused family division.
Yeah, it caused a lot of division in the end.
Yeah, but
possibly even marital division.
Who sinned and caused the famine in the first place? Was it Abraham or the Canaanites?
That's a good question. The text doesn't say. The text doesn't say exactly why the famine came. Whether it's someone's sin or whether it was God testing Abraham. Or God using a natural famine that was going to happen anyway, he uses it to test Abraham.
What's the verse about the famine for the word of God? Where does that come from?
Famine for the word of God?
They're hung. It's in like Hosea. It's one of the prophets.
So I'm thinking.
Well, we have it.
If we need to go back to the sin issue, then here is God making the most amazing and incredible promise. You're going to get this,
right.
this, and this, and if. You'll get everybody's going to get blessed through you, and if they curse you and so on, you're going to have the land, you're going to have inheritance, which are not around.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you're putting the whole thing on hold and saying, well, what matters at the moment is I just survive.
Right.
And I better go down to Egypt and see how we get around it.
Well, sometimes the sin's overwhelming that even the good guys have to leave, like in Sodom and Gomorrah. Or like prophets who have been carried over to the Lord.
If someone's going to get wiped out.
But, you know, then it's overwhelming. And then even the prophets have to suffer and be exiled to Babylon. They don't stick around.
But usually, in that case, God tells them, this is what's going to happen,
sure.
And you need to get out of here.
Yeah.
Abraham wasn't told, hey, I'm punishing this land for their sin. Get out of here.
Right. I'm just saying, sometimes there's a critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody, because you ask who sinned. Sometimes even though you didn't sin, you gotta take the brunt of everybody else's sin.
But maybe God is trying to thin out the Canaanites.
I think the word sin is a weird word.
Yes.
I mean,
he gets sent back to the Negev, so he gets more gold and silver and stuff, but he's right back.
Well, he gets sent back from Pharaoh, right? Yeah, but not necessarily. Right. If you're looking at it from what was God wanting from him, we don't hear any divine instruction. But you're right. He gets put back in the briar patch.
Can I ask, does God always punish when people sin? And how big or bad does the sin have to be?
No, he obviously doesn't. Because we'd be wiped off the map right now.
No, I sinned an hour ago and I repent and I wasn't punished.
No, but I mean,
I
can tell you the phone companies in this country,
we're gonna run out of range.
They got some stuff to account for. There are plenty of companies in this country that have some things to account for. I mean, there's all kinds of things that go on. Does God wipe them out? No, he's full of grace, just like he always has been. But
very often there's a consequence.
There is a consequence. There is a reckoning at some point.
Yeah. But if we say that we have no sin, the truth is not in us. We
exactly.
all sin. But either you repent like David just did an hour ago, good on him.
That's true, because God might call me back to Saturday morning the 19th. Did you do that again? Okay, we learned.
Right.
But
right.
Learn from that.
You know how you call it the temptations, the temptation of Christ,
right.
Or whatever, or Satan. The word really is more test. Because when we think of temptation, we think of somebody trying to make me sin or something.
Right.
And
it's testing.
Yeah, if you really look at testing and
what you do
sin,
in a circumstance.
Yeah, how do you deal with the challenge? So like here, there was a famine in the land. I don't think necessarily anyone sinned. I mean, no one knows, right? But this is...
But it's certainly a test.
But what are you contrasting? I mean, temptation is kind of a test. I mean, what are you saying? Like, they're not necessarily drawn to do something bad, but rather it's
no, he's saying,
like a game?
Let's say nobody sinned, just God set up a system, a physical system, that created a famine in the land at that time. But now Abraham's in that situation, what's he going to do? When you're put in a famine, what are you going to do?
Right.
Is your first thought, well, let me get out of here and go to Egypt?
That has nothing to do with sin.
Do I
how do you respond to that? It's a, in that sense, it's a test. And that's exactly what Rashi thought when he read the passage.
And that's true. Another experience, I mean, I have experienced very recently when I was wanting to do something. I'm not even going to go into the details of it. And the Lord said, hang on, wait. And it was really hard to trust him to work out that particular thing. If I had gone ahead on my own sort of Gemma always gets everything done straight away, that would have been sin.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was a real test, and it was only at the point when I could say, this is really hard, but okay, I'll hang on and wait.
And
so
even
things,
back to the whole waiting, and we don't know exactly, like you said, we don't have written what Abraham and God were communicating to each other, if anything, at this point. But we know God is able to work good even out of bad.
Right.
And so, like Gemma pointed out, after the whole Egypt thing, he does end up even richer. So God was able to work something good out of it. If that's good, I don't know, because then it causes division. But I wanted to point out one other thing. As they're coming close to Egypt, again, if you read some of these old commentators, they're squeezing every word. Listen carefully. In verse 14, Vayhi kevo Avram Mitzrayma. Sorry, I'm in Genesis 12. Genesis 12, verse 14. When Abraham entered Egypt. So, Rashi points out, where's Sarah? It says, when Abraham entered Egypt. And so they have this whole midrash, which is a creative interpretation about, well, where was Sarah? He hid her because she's so beautiful. So how did he hide her? Do you guys know the story?
In a box.
He hid her in a big crate. And he came to customs. And they said, what's in this crate? Open it up. He said, no, I don't want to open it up. Okay, we're going to charge you the custom for pure silver. As if this crate were full of silver. He says, all right, I'll pay it. Oh, he's willing to pay for pure silver. Okay, we're going to charge you the custom for pure gold. He says, okay, I'll pay it. I said, okay. We'll go up the last higher. What's higher than gold and silver in the ancient world? Pearls. We're going to charge you the custom for pure pearls. And Abram said, okay, I'll pay it. I said, oh, okay, we have to know what's in this box, because there's nothing more valuable than pearls. We're going to open it up.
Bible.
So they opened it up, and Sarah's beauty shone throughout the land of Egypt. Okay, so that's the story. But where is it coming from? This little detail in the text. Abram's coming to Egypt, and all of a sudden Sarah isn't mentioned. But then Pharaoh's servants see her, and they praise her to Pharaoh. So they fill in that whole little taxation thing and create a situation where Pharaoh's servants would have seen her beautiful splendor and go throughout Egypt.
That's clearly what happened.
Yeah.
But your point is...
But the point is that they were attending to the detail of the text.
The first phrase of verse 14.
That, you know, Abraham coming in alone after he's just talked to Sarah, all of a sudden she's not in the picture, and yet the servants still see her. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it could also be, if you're going to have a complicated midrash, it could also be that women were really second class. She was hanging around a bit behind.
Well, of course women were second class. That is
And so
obvious.
Abraham comes in, and it's only when she staggers along behind and says, I'm here too,
you know,
they cotton on, she's so beautiful.
The other thing I noticed... They will kill me, but keep you alive. This phrase just struck me, and I didn't even check it. Ve'haya ki yiru otach, Hamitzrim, ואמרו אשתו זאת, והרגו אותי, ואותת יחיו. They'll kill me and they'll keep you alive. It just reminded me all of a sudden of Moses' birth. The Pharaoh says, kill the boys and keep the girls alive. And so it's just interesting here. You know, Sarah, she's a girl, right? She's going to be kept alive. Kill Abram, keep the girl alive. So, well, I don't know, for whatever connection that might be, there it is. But anyway, she gets taken as a wife, okay?
You know,
that's a serious thing.
He must have been very hungry.
Abram.
Yeah.
To be able to give up Sarah.
No, to even want to go to Egypt.
Sure.
If he thought he was going to be killed, probably.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking desperate.
So it was a real famine.
It was a real famine. It says it was a heavy famine. So his wife is taken to Pharaoh's house, and Abram gets gifts, presumably wedding gifts. A lot of stuff. But then, look in verse 17 of Genesis 12, God touches Pharaoh.
This is this word nega.
Big nega. Big negaim. Big touches. And his whole household. Al devar sarai eshet Avram. So if you want some more creative interpretation. At first it sounds kind of like, whoa, how do you know that? But if you compare all the stories, you start thinking, okay, there's something there. But what are God's big touches? It says severe diseases.
Leprosy.
Well, it could be. That is often connected. This word nega is connected to leprosy.
God gave Pharaoh and leprosy.
But Rashi says no. He gave them erectile dysfunction. Why? Because
it's a good clue.
Right. Right, exactly. Because in the area that you're affected, you think, well, what have I done wrong to cause this? And you naturally think, oh, I took someone else's wife. You know, like there would be that kind of judgment for judgment. The other thing, when you compare She's My Sister, we have three stories, right, of She's My Sister? Mm-hmm. Two of Abraham, one of Isaac. And in each of them, a different thing happens, slightly different. In this one, it's the worst. Because in the other ones, it says, oh, he didn't, before he could touch her, or he didn't actually touch her. Here, it says, she was saying to his household. It doesn't say he didn't touch her.
What's he did in conservative society, once a woman disappears behind the doors of another household by herself,
already defiled, no matter what happens.
Doesn't matter.
But what I'm saying is the fact that it doesn't say specifically she wasn't touched,
right.
In the other context it does,
uh-huh.
We can safely assume she was touched.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And so therefore God touched Pharaoh back.
Right.
Because Abram's not going to tell you, I'm going to tell you, you did something wrong.
Right.
And so, and that is Pharaoh's reply, is like, what have I done to cause this? Everybody in my household all of a sudden can't reproduce.
And
what's wrong?
And it also ties up with the fact later on that we know she's barren.
Mm.
In spite of whatever happens, with or without Pharaoh.
Right.
And, I mean, it could be that he really didn't do anything. He was disabled, let's say.
Okay. So let's say he's disabled.
Or it could be that he was,
whatever disease God put on him, in verse 17, his natural response in verse 18 is to call Abram and say, what have you done? Why didn't you tell me it was your wife? Well, how did he know? No angel appeared to him, that's
right.
Recorded.
Right.
So he's putting two and two together based on his punishment, what his crime must have been.
Or Sarah told him.
Okay, so this is the other midrash they have. If you hear, God put big, big strikes or big negaim, big touches on all his household, it says, Al devar sarai. On the word of Sarah, or it could be interpreted about the issue of Sarah, which makes sense, right? Because of Sarah. But But they kind of play with it, and they say,
words.
By the word of Sarah.
Where are you now?
I'm in verse 17. So that Sarah could kind of like pray to God really quickly, and by her word, God would strike people. Like, Lord, that one over there. That one there. Right now, here.
In Hebrew, because the Lord inflicted serious disease on her and his household because of Abraham's wife.
It's this phrase, because of Abraham's wife, Sarah.
The word because is al-bab.
It's al-bab.
Al-bab.
Wow.
Every time you go from one language to another, you have to take one interpretation. But in the original, a word can have two meanings. So if you're dealing with the original word, you can play with both of those meanings. You lose that once you change languages.
Well, in the English, because can kind of still, but you don't really hear it in English.
No.
You don't hear it.
Well, you wouldn't get the idea that Sarah could give a command
and
God would touch them.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have translated because of the word of Sarah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But it doesn't say that.
You know, in English, when we say he's a little touched, doesn't that kind of mean like he's a little mentally handicapped?
Yeah.
Or I thought it was down.
Slightly around the bend.
What's the old barber shape? Literally means on the way.
Okay, so.
Wow, that's amazing.
So Pharaoh says, take your wife and get out of here. And he sent people to escort them, right? He expelled them from Egypt. So, so Abram has to come back to the land, right? So in the beginning of chapter 13, Abram's coming back up from Egypt.
So was God at work in that?
I think so. I think so. And it's interesting, if you're reading this text with our King's text, because in the King's it's talking about if you sin and go into exile, and then you repent there and you look back to this land, God will bring you back. Where here it's kind of reversed, where Abram chose to go to exile. He did not choose to come back, and he's like put back. So it's kind of, you see a little subtle irony there. And he comes back with a lot of stuff. So starting with a heavy famine, chapter 13 brings it back. He comes back to the land, and he's heavy with cattle, silver, and gold.
And it's me'od.
Yes, he's very heavy with cattle, silver, and gold. That's
so
verse 2.
How does one decide that given what we're talking about, that God's hand is in something? Or maybe it's not God. Maybe it's just happening.
Well,
yeah.
That's where you have to rely on the Holy Spirit and be an astute reader of the text.
Mm.
Because it is subtle. But I think if you keep reading through Genesis, you'll see how it doesn't have to say things directly to mean it. Much of our human communication, we mean things that we don't actually have to say in exact words. That's just the nature of languages.
I mean, just going back to the King's connection again, it is clear. You brought out of the iron smelting furnace.
Right.
So we're back at this testing that he went
well,
through.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that...
And may your eyes be open to your servants, plead for the plea of your people Israel. May you listen to them whenever they cry. For you single them out from all the nations of the world to be your own inheritance.
Seeing Egypt as a testing ground comes in the first king.
That's right.
And yet, in this famine, in this context, is where we actually see a test going on, if you read between the lines.
Right.
So it's kind of like this could be commenting on that.
That's great.
And we also have this mention of the land given to the ancestors praying towards the land. Did you notice that in this text? There's circles of meaning. Solomon built his temple here, and we can pray towards the temple. But we can also, where did I draw three? Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem. We can pray towards the city, and we can pray towards the land.
And we can pray towards the holy place. So
yeah.
It's three levels. You know.
Yeah, and well, even if you're a foreigner, God's going to hear you when you pray. But notice it says, you've caused your name to dwell here, but you don't dwell here. you dwell in heaven. But when people pray here, because of your namesake, I'm going to hear, you're going to hear from heaven.
What's your point about the concentric circles?
Just that this is what it shows. This is the picture it shows. I don't know how that directly connects to here, but we have the promise of the land here, given to the ancestors, and stay in the land and you'll be blessed, basically. And Abraham voluntarily leaves to Egypt.
So you can
and when you're in Egypt, you're supposed to pray towards the land, and God's going to hear you. Of course, in Abraham's day, the temple hasn't been built yet. But this is a curious thing. Okay, so he gets sent out of Egypt. And where does he go? Where's the first place he goes? To the Negev. Because he starts the Negev. If you're coming from Egypt, you're coming up through the south. The Negev is in the south. And it says he's full of stuff. And then verse 3. He goes on his journey from the Negev to
Bet-El,
to the first place, Ben Bet-El uVen Ha'ar. Right? So he goes back to where he first built his altar. And that's maybe a little bit of my connection. Here you have Solomon building a temple in a certain place, commemorating, calling on the name of the Lord.
Right.
And so Abram, after this whole testing ordeal, you can interpret that he says, okay, I'm going to go back to when I knew God spoke to me. I built this altar. He called me to this land. It's almost like a little renewal of a covenant here. I'm going to go back to that first altar. We're going to start again, and I'm going to see what's going to happen.
So is Abraham a bit lost at that point, confused? So I go back to where it works.
Maybe. It's one way to read it.
But not to Shechem.
No, not to Shechem. But it says twice, to the place that he made his tent in the beginning, between Beit El and Ai. And then in verse 4, to the place of his altar that he made there in the first. And he called the name of the Lord. So it kind of says it twice, that he's going back to the beginning, back to the beginning. But now in verse 5 of chapter 12, we have, by the way, Lot's with Abraham. And then you have this whole conflict. And you could say maybe that's another test. We did several Bible studies on Lot and Abraham last year. And if you remember from that, it was brought out that Lot, being part of Abraham's family, could have been seen as the heir, Abraham's heir. And so when they part ways, Abraham just lost a physical family heir. And I'm using heir, this heir, descendant. And so now, how is God's blessing? All these blessings are to Abraham and his seed, right? That's his physical descendant. And which also is a connection. You and your seed is in here and here. You and seed. Or fathers and seed.
Tell me, why is God testing the whole time? Is it to check to see if he's, quote, chosen the right person?
Why do we test that?
To make possibly to make us stronger.
Exactly.
Possibly to make us rely on him.
Exactly.
Possibly to see if we are the right people or person to do a particular job.
Sure. To build character, I would say all of those things.
Okay.
And that's what he does to Abraham.
Okay.
The other thing, we need to end now, but if you remember when Lot and Abraham are separating, of course Abraham should have been the one to choose, right? Lot's younger, but Abraham is a very humble person, and he gives first choice to Lot. But Lot, we have a contrast. The land he actually chooses doesn't even seem to be part of Canaan. Let's read that verse really quick. He says, if you go south, I'll go north. Or if you go yamin and smol. Right is south, left is north in the Bible. You're always facing east, west is behind you.
It's also questionable whether he should have done, because God told him which land he's supposed to do, then if Lot would have chosen the land he's supposed to go into, he's not supposed to go the other way.
Right. Yeah, so this is a subtle thing. He says, okay, so separate from me. If you go small, shamal, if you go north, I'll go south. And if you go south, I'll go north. That's in verse 9.
Just say it again. Left and right is north-south, right?
Right.
That's right.
I actually think that's east-west. Right?
No. You face the east.
Your orientation
is orient. Orient, east.
Okay.
So right in the Bible is south, left is north. So Abram's saying, look, here's the land we've been promised. If you go to the north, I'll take the south. If you take the south, I'll take the north. And what does Lot reply? He looks up and he says, I think I'll go east. That wasn't even part of the option, was it? It says he saw Kikar HaYarden, and it was all pretty and la la la. So in verse 11, Mi Keden, from the east.
So it would be more like Moab or...
So he separated. He went in what was not on the ridge, I guess what was considered not quite Canaan, if you will.
Like Madaba.
Yeah. I'll go to the east.
Which is Moab.
No, in the plains.
The plains, the Kikar HaYarden is the area... basically the Dead Sea area where it's kind of like an open plaza. I don't know how to say
Jordan it. Jordan does look greener if you're standing right there.
Yeah.
Jordan's nice.
That's true.
Jordan is nice.
Yeah.
So in a sense, this is maybe a bigger blow for Abraham than he at first thought. You know, they have some disagreements, but they're still brothers, right? And he's thinking, we'll just separate, you go... I'm brothers, I'm using family.
Brother.
Your family.
Yeah.
He's lots of nephews.
Right.
But we'll still be in the land together, right? You'll just be in your area, I'll be in mine. And then Lot's response is like, no, I think I'm just going to go over there. Forget you and your promised land. Yeah, I'm going to go there because it looks good.
And maybe there's an extra reference to it's like Egypt because he was kicked out of
Egypt. He just came from Egypt.
Abram, and maybe
mm-hmm.
God, wait a minute.
Yeah, I've had enough of this. I'm just going to go... to where I'm on my own, insecure, and never mind. And so for Abraham, now all of a sudden he's left without any family inheritor, right? He's old, he's 75 or more, and
sure.
So you can think about that.
He was born when Terah was 70 or something. He was not that old
for them, okay.
At least for the
but
man.
It's not like he's starting out on life.
No.
But now he is. So I'll leave you with that. Come back next week and we'll continue in chapter 14 of Genesis and in the